You're with us as we talk dinosaurs here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for joining us. So there's this new chemical analysis on dinosaur eggshells, and the findings may help settle this long-running debate about whether dinosaurs were warm-blooded. Scientists, they mostly agree that feathered dinosaurs called theropods that gave rise to birds were warm-blooded, but there isn't consensus on whether other groups of dinosaurs are warm-blooded or whether they more resemble cold-blooded reptiles. So what do you want scientists to research and discover about dinosaurs? What information would you like to know? We're at 800-642-1234. Robin Dawson is a postdoctoral research associate at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She was part of a study out of Yale University analyzing dinosaur egg fossils. It was published in the journal Science Advances. Robin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we talk fossil eggshells, I want to just touch base with you on COVID-19. Is there any type of research or studies out there on dinosaurs that we might find what made them most vulnerable, that made them susceptible to a great outbreak of catastrophe?
It's hard, I think, to really get specific, partly because we get only a fraction view of their anatomy, right? The fossil record, we really just get their hard parts, so bones and teeth usually, sometimes impressions. So I think things like arthritis, if they had a fracture and the bone healed again, those are the kinds of things we could probably identify in the fossil record. But yeah, I'm not an expert on this and diseases, but I know that some studies have looked at things they can actually see in fossil bone, like weird ways the bones have grown that's actually preserved.
You're at University of Massachusetts Amherst. What precautions is your campus taking? How is your lab doing research at all right now?
Yeah, it's challenging. Fortunately, we're wearing gloves all the time in the lab, so that helps. I actually feel a lot better doing lab work than other types of work. But we're just taking a lot of extra precautions. We're signing up for time, so there's never, you know, more than two people. We're at different lab benches, so we're at least 6 feet apart from each other, wiping down all the surfaces with isopropanol, so... Yeah, it's a little bit different, but we're getting through it.
And I would assume students aren't getting their lab work, lab classes done either.
No, and, you know, I know it's challenging for a lot of faculty to move to virtual teaching and video lectures, but, you know, I think it's better for all of us just to be safe and really stop the spread of this, so...
Well, let's turn to fossils now. What can a geologist learn about an extinct species just by looking at these fossils?
Well, they can learn quite a lot. I think one of the really cool things about what I do, I'm a geochemist, so... You know, sort of traditionally, a lot of paleontologists look at the morphology of limb bones or fully articulated skeletons or teeth, and they can tell a lot about an animal size. They can estimate how much it weighed. You know, they can look at its dentition and estimate what sort of things it ate. But with geochemistry, you can get sort of beyond that and ask sort of deeper questions. That are beyond just sort of what you can see visually. So sort of my main tool that I use in my research is something called stable isotope geochemistry. And that is based on the ratio or the ordering of atoms within the minerals that make up fossils. So,
So where atoms are organized, where they are, can help us understand a little bit more about, you know, temperature and what that, you know, what that animal was like?
Definitely. So it can tell us about temperature. In our study, we use something called clumped isotope paleothermometry. That involves two heavy stable isotopes. So that, for example, carbon and oxygen are what we use. Carbon traditionally, it does, by definition, have six protons and six neutrons, so it has a mass of 12. But if you have a heavy carbon, you have one additional neutron, so it has a mass of 13. What our technique is based on is the bonds within the eggshell. The eggshell is made of calcite, same thing that your chicken eggs that you eat for breakfast are made out of, also made of calcite. The calcite mineral is calcium and carbonate, so Ca, calcium, carbonate, CO, oxygen. There's three oxygens. And so if a carbon and an oxygen that are bound together in this shell mineral lattice, if they're both the heavy isotope, that is a really, really strong bond. Mm. And it's really hard to break, particularly when there's two heavy isotopes involved.
We're talking with Robin Dawson, a postdoctoral research associate at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's a geochemist who has been studying fossils to learn the history of the Earth and specifically fossil eggshells. You can join in 800-642-1234. What do you want to learn about her system of clumped isotope paleothermometry? What do you want to know about what scientists are looking at with these dinosaur fossils? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Robin, in the past, researchers have used teeth to learn more about dinosaurs. What information have we learned from examining teeth, and was that a springboard to anything else?
The technique we use has only really been around for about 15 years or so. Previous studies have used single isotopes to estimate maybe what dinosaurs ate, maybe the composition of the water that they drank. And this is based on looking at these isotopes in their teeth. So if you think about it, if they're eating food, if they're drinking water, those are sort of the building blocks in their diet, right? Same for us, that they then use to make their body's tissues as they grow. That's sort of what has been done in the past. But there was a study very early on when this technique was being developed that looked at teeth to look at dinosaur body temperatures. But it really only looked at the long-neck dinosaurs, Littlefoot from Land Before Time.
Gotcha.
These large sort of giraffe-like dinosaurs. They found that their body temperatures were warm based on this ordering of the atoms in their teeth. This was still sort of a question then of whether their body temperatures were warm, sort of around 35 degrees Celsius. If this was because they were warm-blooded or because they were just so big. When you're a big animal and you have a small surface area to volume ratio, it's actually hard to lose your core body heat because you have less surface area, so you're able to retain your heat better. So it was still this outstanding question of really why they were warm or why they had warm body temperatures.
We're talking about what dinosaur eggshell fossils tell us with Robin Dawson. She is a geochemist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Her research team's findings on eggshell geochemistry came out last month. What questions do you have regarding dinosaurs or creatures predating them? What do you wish you knew? What questions do you have about ancient animals and their time on Earth and what fossils can tell us? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with Robin Dawson here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're exploring new analysis on dinosaur eggshells. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And this might help settle a long debate over whether dinosaurs were cold-blooded like reptiles or warm-blooded like mammals and birds. The researchers got a hold of dinosaur fossils and their eggshells, and with sophisticated testing, they figured out the body temperature of the mother when the shells were formed. Why do you think we should know whether dinosaurs evolved to be warm-blooded? Do you think this tells us more about how mammals are today? What questions do you have about dinosaurs and when they roamed the Earth? Join in 800-642-1234. Robin Dawson specializes in geochemistry at UMass Amherst, and she was part of the team that analyzed the dino eggshells. She stays with us. Let's take a call now. Patrick is with us from Reedsburg. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, my question. My question relates to like if you were to, you know, cut a cross section out of a hill, you can see the stratification of, you know, time, right? If left undisturbed. My question is, are you able to see, relating back to the isotopes and atomic, you know, that was brought up before, are you able to see like that stratification of the big event that might have taken these creatures off this planet, out of existence? Is there a signature there that shows that?
Yes, there definitely is. And I've actually seen it in two locations. But, you know, because the impact affected the globe, you know, we have this crater off the coast of Mexico, the Chicxulub crater, which pretty much all scientists agree that that is what caused the mass extinction of the dinosaurs at the end of the Cretaceous. This impact, this huge impact, sent a bunch of material up into the atmosphere. And so you can actually see a thin layer of clay at the extinction boundary, like you're talking about the strata. And that clay layer is really rich in this element that we just, like, don't have at Earth's surface. It's really only something you can get from an extraterrestrial source, something like a huge rock meteor hitting the Earth. And that's an iridium. So this really rich iridium layer, this clay layer that's rich in iridium, there's an outcrop of it in Montana, if you want to take a road trip out there. And there's a really famous one in Italy. But this is something that you can, if it outcrops, it's definitely like a global layer of this material from the impact.
Well, Patrick, thanks for the question. Let's take another question here. CERN is with us from Granton. Hi, CERN.
Hi. Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, that kind of took the wind out of my question, but the question was like, could it have been a disease? And we were taught two of our tar pits.
About tar pits?
Yeah.
I don't know. Tar pits, the only tar pits I know of being associated with, like, fossil deaths, and I'm not a paleontologist, so I don't know everything there is out there about all fossils, but the one I know of most famously is the La Brea tar pits, but that was sort of around the time of the Ice Ages, so much later in time, much younger, we would say, not as old as the dinosaurs. So things like mammoths and saber-toothed cats are wandering the Earth at this time. The dinosaurs are already extinct. But no, the extinction of the dinosaurs is pretty ubiquitously said to be the impact at Chicxulub. The Chicxulub impact is what caused the mass extinction. There is... sort of around the same time, there's these huge flood basalts in India called the Deccan Traps that are erupting, sort of leading up to the extinction of the dinosaurs. But I think most scientists would say that it maybe had some slight added impact to the climate at the time, but was not the main driver of the extinction.
CERN, thanks for the call. We are talking with Robin Dawson this morning, an author of a Yale study that looked at the chemistry of dinosaur egg shells and what they can tell us about whether dinosaurs were warm-blooded. Your questions front and center here on Dinosaurs, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Robin, why do scientists... have a long-running debate over whether dinosaurs were warm-blooded or cold-blooded? Why does it matter so much?
Well, I think, you know, since they were named terrible lizards, we've for a long time just had this image in our head.
Might have had a little bias there.
Yeah, we were just like, you know, I know I did when I was a kid. I, like, pictured Godzilla, basically, in my head. So, you know, I think it wasn't until we really started finding fossil remains with feathers and feather-like features on them that we started thinking, like, wait a minute, were these like, cold-blooded, scaly things? Or were they more like birds, the group that evolved from dinosaurs and the living group we have today, birds? So, yeah, I mean, I think we're just always learning new things from the fossil record. It's really like the metaphor of keep digging is really real with paleontology. You find a new fossil, you learn more. But that being said, it's also sort of the luck of the draw because you do have to find the fossils.
You do have to go find them. That's right. Let's bring in Hannah now in Madison with a question on the dinosaur fossil record. Hi, Hannah.
Hi there.
What's your question?
I'm wondering how common it is to find dinosaur eggs in the fossil record.
So actually, fragments are pretty common. We do sometimes find, and the site we found some of our material at Devil's Coulee, which is in Alberta, Canada, you can sometimes find a full nest with, like, the almost whole, it's very cracked, but whole eggs basically in it. But little fragments of eggshell can be pretty common, particularly in what we call microfossil bone beds. It's sort of a process-based bone bed. They're often formed when you get a channel or a river cutting across a floodplain, and basically it just picks up everything in its wake, you know. Anything living on the floodplain in the surrounding area, this river cuts through it, picks it up in the river, and then when the river, you know, cuts around a bend, it drops all these heavy material it's carrying into the, you know, sort of cut bank of this channel, and then you have this sort of deposit of all this material sampled from the region. So in these microfossil sites, you can get eggshell, you can get teeth, you can get scales, bits of turtle shell, alligator.
It's almost like a soup. It's like
sort of. Yeah. It's a good way, you know, obviously it's great to find a fully articulated specimen of a whole animal, but that's rare. But these sort of bone beds are really useful for sort of just getting a snapshot of the whole sort of community, ecological community, and what lived. It's just a taste of the animals, you know, but they can be very diagnostic.
How do you know a fragment of a fossil eggshell is just that, a fragment of an eggshell?
Speaking of diagnostic, the eggshell is very particular sometimes to the group of dinosaur. So, you know, you just sort of clue in, you find these things a lot. You either find a full egg that's associated with a body fossil, you know, oh, this eggshell, it has more bumps or more pores in the surface, and I found it near this body fossil, so it must be produced by this dinosaur. That's really how we do it. So we're actually able to often identify sort of broadly what group of dinosaur produced the eggshell just by finding it, you know, in association with body fossils, or sometimes even the embryo is preserved within the egg.
So how did you curate your eggshells? Did you actually go out to get them in Canada, or did someone else get them for you?
So I did not, unfortunately. I've been to a sort of time correlative, so basically if you imagine the world 75 million years ago, and our sites are sort of, there's a shallow seaway basically flooding the continent of North America. So it's very Mediterranean-esque seashore, basically along, you know, western states and western Canada. So Alberta would have been like seafront property.
Beachfront property in Montana.
And then I was in sort of I've been to sites in the sort of U.S. equivalent of these sites in Montana. But no, my co-authors, Francois and Daniel, went to the sites in Alberta, Devil's Coulee, and they collected a lot of this material.
You also got some from Romania.
Yes, and I'm not totally sure, but so Francois Tirian, he's a curator at the Terrell Museum in Alberta, and he's a taphonomist, which basically is and a sedimentologist. So he studies basically how fossils get preserved and how they end up in the fossil record. But he works with paleontologists a lot. So he has curated all this material at the Terrell.
We're talking with Robin Dawson, who is a geosciences researcher at UMass Amherst. Her doctoral work has focused on well-preserved fossil eggshells, which we're talking about. Her new research, published in the journal Science Advances, proposes dinosaurs were actually warm-blooded creatures. Why do you think it's important to know why dinosaurs were more like mammals than reptiles? What do you want to know about dinosaur eggshells? We're at 800-642-1234. Back after this news update here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking about 75-million-year-old dinosaur eggshells. Scientists studied the arrangement of atoms in these fossil eggshells to determine that the moms who carried the eggs had warmer body temperatures than their surrounding environment. And this research may also help us understand why dinosaurs evolved to grow feathers. So what do you want to know about fossil eggshells and how researchers figured out the mother's body temperature? What puzzles you about dinosaurs and what their life was like when they walked this planet? Join in 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Robin Dawson is a postdoctoral research associate at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where she analyzes the chemistry of extinct species with fossils, and she stays with us. So, Robin, we had a caller who couldn't stay with us but wants to know what you got into wanting to research fossils. Have you ever been on a dig, and why did you want to do this research?
I think, like most kids growing up, I thought dinosaurs were really cool. I always liked biology. I always liked doing lab work. My family vacations were always very outdoorsy, and I had a tendency to always collect rocks and seashells, so there's probably an inherent tendency towards geology and paleontology just from a young age. My first class in college was a vertebrate paleontology class, and I just got really fascinated about learning what the rock record could tell us about Earth's past. I learned sort of that there's this field using geochemistry called paleoecology, where you actually learn how the animals and their environment, climate, how that interacts. And so that's really what interests me, is sort of recreating the whole scene, so that's why I study it.
We have another caller here asking, what did the incubation for eggs look like for dinosaurs million of years ago? Considering how big these animals are, did they sit on their eggs? What was that like?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know a lot about the behavior. I know there's been studies about it. In fact, Myasora, one of the groups of dinosaurs that we study, one of the duck-billed dinosaurs. The name actually, I think, means good mother lizard or something like that. I think they do have some sense of whether they really, really sort of cared for the nest while it was nesting, but it's not my specialty, so I don't know a lot of details about it.
Okay.
But I do know they find, the body fossils sometimes in very close proximity to the nests.
So these eggshell fossils that you have been studying, you gather them, you have to preserve them and protect them, but I understand you have to destroy them in order to study them.
Yes. Yes, this is a destructive technique. So we have to, unfortunately, dissolve these eggshell fragments in acid. We're actually, as I mentioned, the mineral is calcite, calcium carbonate. That carbonate ion, it dissolves, it actually produces CO2, so carbon dioxide, and that's what we measure. And it's that ordering of carbon and oxygen and the carbon dioxide that we're interested in. I think, you know, in the interests of museums, they're willing to let us use the fossils and destructively sample them because they're these, like I mentioned, fragments of eggshell, just because it's worth it to get the information out of the destructive analyses and learn more about these creatures. So, yeah.
So of the dinosaur eggshells you studied, of these different dinosaurs, what type of body temperatures did you arrive at, and how do they compare to humans?
Yeah, so I guess... Well, it depends on the mammal, but for the three major groups of dinosaurs we looked at, so we had a mysore, which was representative of this group that's most distantly related to birds, the Ornithischian dinosaurs, and then we looked at a specimen that we think is representative of the sauropods, and then one of the most interesting ones, I think, was this Truodon, which is representative of the theropods, and it's the a dinosaur that to date is the most closely related to birds that has been studied with this technique. And we actually found that these three specimens that represent the three major groups of dinosaurs actually had body temperatures that were all warmer than their environment and within the range that we see with modern mammals and birds, so modern endothermic animals, excuse me. So they were either, somewhere around 35, 40 degrees Celsius.
And so this is warmer than the environment around them?
Yes. They're either bracketing the sort of environmental temperatures, or they're raising their temperature above ambient. So, for example, the Truodon, we actually have three specimens of a Truodon, all from Alberta, Canada. And we wanted to be really careful, like I mentioned earlier, with the sauropods. You know, they could be warm, but it could just be warm because they're big. So we really wanted to have constraint on the environmental temperature. So we also looked at things that we know are ectothermic, that things that temperatures are controlled by their environment. So we looked at some snail and some bivalves, freshwater bivalves. And those shells gave us temperatures more around like 25, 28 degrees Celsius. And that is sort of representative of what the summers would have been like in Alberta.
Can you translate that to Fahrenheit?
So maybe around like 80, okay. 85, yeah.
Talking with Robin Dawson, the author of a Yale study who examined the chemistry of dinosaur eggs that helped her understand perhaps some of these dinos were warm-blooded. Her research focuses on geology and geochemistry. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Robin, by knowing more about the mothers and what their body temperature was like, does that give us any indication of what the surrounding climate was like, the environment was like for when these dinosaurs lived?
Not so much the mother's body temperature, but, you know, like I said, we have a lot of other things, like we used mollusks, but you can use a lot of fossil material to estimate climate. And that was actually sort of the main focus of my dissertation work while at Yale. But pretty much anything that leaves behind part of its skeleton or part of its of what its living tissue was, there are many ways to estimate temperature. And so we used clumped isotopes, same thing we used to estimate dinosaur body temperatures, on tiny little protists that live in the surface ocean. They're called foraminifera. We've used it on mollusks. So in this paper, we look at gastropods and bivalves, but you can also look at mollusks that live in the ocean, like oyster like creatures, or ammonites, which if people are dinosaur fans, then we might also have some ammonite fans out there. these huge, like the Nautilus today, they dominated the Cretaceous ocean. So when the dinosaurs were around, these things were all over the ocean.
So this isotope research is very transferable to other creatures at that time.
Exactly. And so, you know, we can really get at the climate, and that was the one thing we were really interested in, is estimating the surface temperature of the ocean at the time the dinosaurs were around, and actually before that as well. Just because the time of the dinosaurs was unlike today. It was actually one of the, like, warmest greenhouses. There's sort of this peak greenhouse period around 94, 93 million years ago, so a little older than the dinosaurs we're looking at in our paper. There's estimates that, you know, this greenhouse climate, there's no ice at the poles. Like I said, sea level has risen, so there's this shallow seaway spanning North America from the Arctic Circle to the Gulf of Mexico, just cutting the continent. And there's estimates that the CO2 at this time was anywhere from 2 times, maybe 8 times pre-industrial levels. So pre-industrial levels of CO2 are 180 parts per million, and we're sitting above 400 right now.
So very informative as we look at climate change today, what the environment was like for dinosaurs.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to me because it's sort of the extreme case of a greenhouse climate. We have a lot of fossil evidence that, you know, life was thriving, but a very different type of life, very different world than the world we know today.
We're talking with Robin Dawson about that world so long ago, millions of years ago. She's in the Department of Geosciences at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, looking at fossilized dinosaur eggshells. She was part of a team at Yale that studied eggs from 3 different groups of dinosaurs, revealing they actually had warmer blood than their surrounding environment. So what lingering questions do you have about dinosaurs? Why do dinosaurs fascinate you and your kids? Why should we investigate their bodies and the climate lived in? Still time for you. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Robin Dawson right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. New research on dinosaur fossil eggshells found that all major groups of dinosaurs had warmer body temperatures than their environment. So this may help unlock another mystery, and that is why dinosaurs evolved to grow feathers. What questions do you have about dinosaurs or creatures predating them? Why does it matter that we know whether dinos were warm-blooded and why they grew feathers? Still time for you at 800-642-1234. Robin Dawson is a postdoctoral research associate at UMass Amherst, and she led a study as a doctoral student at Yale analyzing the chemistry of dinosaur eggs. So, Robin, give us a connection here from your findings that these dinosaurs may have been warm-blooded to how we get feathers on dinosaurs.
Well, I don't know if it's sort of in that order. We actually see feather-like features, or sort of simple feathers, really early on. There was a recent study actually a year ago that thought feather-like features in pterosaurs. These aren't even dinosaurs. So although when you're a kid, you often think they are. So pterosaurs are the sort of flying reptiles, but they're not actually dinosaurs. They share a common ancestor to dinosaurs, but they're not. So finding a feather-like feature in a group that's that distantly related to birds was pretty surprising. So I think it's sort of interesting that we see this feature sort of cropping up in these groups that are distantly related to birds. The true sort of veined, more like flight feathers, we don't really see until the theropod dinosaurs. But I think it's interesting because sort of the theropods, as you're reaching sort of the end of the Cretaceous, they get sort of smaller and smaller. I think our findings sort of pose an interesting question: is if they are getting smaller and smaller. I mentioned this sort of surface area to volume ratio with big dinosaurs. When you're smaller, you actually have a higher surface area to volume ratio. It's easier to lose your body heat. So it's possible that maybe at least the feathers in the group that would become birds was actually useful in retaining that body heat.
Paul sent us an email asking, what does your work tell us about evolution and divergence of egg-laying creatures such as reptiles and birds? Can we make any inferences there?
Well, reptiles and birds are actually both part of the amniota, which is defined by egg-laying. Mammals, we're outside of that group, but they actually are united by that feature.
Where does your research go next? I mean, we haven't really settled the debate whether all dinosaurs were warm-blooded. What happens next?
Yeah, I mean, I think our results, the most likely conclusion to make from our results from these representatives of the three major groups is that the most likely answer is then their last common ancestor for all Dinosauria also was able to metabolically control its body temperature as, quote, warm-blooded. You're right. I think, it would be really good to sort of fill in our understanding with other dinosaur remains. So find different eggshells representative of different species from different locations and analyze those as well. There's definitely parts of the story to fill in for sure.
Well, what can you leave us with? Any final thoughts as we think differently about dinosaurs today?
I just think it's good to keep an open mind. Like we talked about in the beginning, this idea of dinosaurs has changed so much over the last couple decades. And I think it's important to not hold onto your ideas too strongly and have an open mind. Because it is. Every time we find a new fossil, we learn something new. This technique, is only 15 years old. Every time a new way of analyzing material becomes possible, you learn something new, a new chemical technique, new way of extracting DNA, new way of... People are looking at pigments in fossil remains now and understanding, the color their feathers had.
So lots to explore. Robin,
yes.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Robin Dawson is a postdoctoral research associate in the Department of Geosciences at University of Massachusetts Amherst. And we have a link, by the way, to the study that's published in the journal Science Advances. You can find it at WPR.org/mornings. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a writer's own food tradition.
Is there really anything better than a buttery, flaky pastry filled with meat and vegetables, or perhaps just vegetables for our vegetarian friends? The pasty has long been a staple in certain Wisconsin communities and has a rich history with a particular group of workers. Jane Jensky went to learn more about the role of pasties in Wisconsin history.
Imagine this. It's early morning in a small Wisconsin town about a century ago. The sun hasn't risen, but parents bustle around the kitchen. They're making pasties, One's for Dad, who's preparing for a day in the mines. Some are for the children, who are about to head to their one-room schoolhouse. The extras are for Mom to warm up for dinner tonight. The pasty is convenient, handheld, and delicious. It's a flaky, buttery pastry, folded over, pinched at the crust, bursting with meat and vegetables. The more traditional fillings might include beef, rutabagas, onions, and potatoes.
Okay, could we do two of the Greek?
Joe's Pasty Shop has been making these savory pies for decades. Jessica Lapachin opened a location in Rhinelander 15 years ago. She talks about the business's history while her husband Larry chops onions.
So Joe's Pasty Shop is a third generation pasty business. My family opened up Joe's Pasty Shop in Ironwood, Michigan in 1946.
Miners from Cornwall, England flocked to Wisconsin in the 1800s. They settled in places like Mineral Point and Miner's Grove, as more lead was needed for things like paint, pipes, and lead shot. Cornish miners brought their mining expertise for extracting galena, which is a mineral used to make lead. They also brought a piece of their European culture, the pasty.
It's a portable meal that the Cornish miners would have taken down into the mine, a handheld meal that they could hold with dirty hands, and they would hang on to the crimp of the crust, eat the center, and throw the crimp away.
While the pasties kept the miners nourished, they also thought the scraps could bring them good luck.
So there's a superstition in mining culture of these spirits that live in the mine. They're called Tommyknockers. And so they would do things like move tools around or hide things from the miners. And so, you know, the miners started to think, well, we have to appease them. Let's give them the crust of our pasties. So they would toss that into the corners of the mine. So
when the demand for lead decreased in southwestern Wisconsin, many Cornish miners moved to the Upper Peninsula to work in copper and iron mines. Pasties became a family tradition, passed on from generation to generation. Lapachin says hers isn't the only family with a pasty story.
And it's a very familiar, memorable food for people. People are really passionate about their favorite pasty and their pasty stories and the way their grandmother made them.
Inside Joe's is regular customer LJ Summers. He didn't grow up with pasties and had his first one when he moved to Rhinelander.
In the past year since I've lived in the neighborhood, and everybody was like, you need to go get a pasty. And so I did, and I've been hooked ever since.
Summers is now a pasty fanatic. He can't stay away from the shop for more than a week.
I like the Greek pasty a lot. That's definitely my favorite. And then my new favorite recently is the Cornish one, because that one goes unannounced. Like, I feel like nobody pays attention to it because of the rutabagas. People are scared of rutabagas.
Even after the fall of the mining era in Wisconsin, people's love of pasties lives on.
Oh, there's something about your pasty. There's something about your pasty. There's something about your pasty that is fine, fine, fine.
That story about pasties in Wisconsin came from Jane Jensky. She's a UW-Madison student working on an internship for Wisconsin Life and Wisconsin 101, which tells the history of the state through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.